This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Thank you, and welcome to Risk Revolution, a monthly series of the Voices in Validation podcast brought to you by the IVT Network. The goal of this series is to advance the maturity of risk management practices within industry by covering topics that challenge quality professionals to continuously pursue opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, our series coordinator, Nuala, is joined by Jayat Moon for a Meet the Author review of his book, Foundations in Quality Risk Management, published in 2020 through ASQ. So welcome to both of you. It's so great to have you.
Well, thank you, Stacy. And as always, it's great to be back with our monthly crusade to revolutionize risk. And today I'm so excited to be joined by Jayat Moon, who has very graciously agreed to come in and talk to us about his own risk journey and share some of the very practical insights from his book, Foundations in Quality Risk Management, as you mentioned. I stumbled across this sometime during the pandemic, and I was absolutely delighted to get my hands on a copy and to see, you know, a very fresh approach to what can, and what we've discussed on this podcast, what can become a quite stale business process. So in particular, I'm looking forward to hearing Jayat's thoughts on how risk management is central to the science of prediction and decision making, which is one of the quotes from his book, and how holistic and scientific risk management can create resilient organizations, which not only survive, but thrive by being adaptable. So some great topics for us to discuss. So welcome, Jayat, to the Risk Revolution podcast. And perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your own journey to become a quality risk management thought leader.
Yes, thank you, Stacy and Noel. I'm delighted to be here. And judging by the brief framework of topics you plan to discuss, I'm very impressed that you have very deftly picked out all the interesting and critical threads in my book. So very much looking forward to our discussion. As far as my introduction, I have a master's degree in biomedical engineering from Drexel University in Philadelphia. I'm involved with the Project Management Institute. I'm a certified risk management professional with PMI. Also a chartered quality professional in the UK. And I have a couple of other certifications for risk management from RIMS and Enterprise Risk Management Society. I'm a fellow of the International Institute of Risk and Safety Management. And as far as my introduction to risk management goes, I think that my first job ever after graduating and my first day ever, I was assigned the task of filling out a risk table. That in my first ever hour. So that's where it all started. It was basically a failure reporting and corrective action system for a pump in a power plant. And that's where my journey started. And then I moved over to other disciplines. I moved over to product development. I became a manufacturing engineer, then entered quality. And I found that risk management, while it was present in each and every department or function, what have you, it could make a huge difference, but nobody was leveraging it. It was almost always, like a reactive paper exercise done mostly for compliance purposes and paperwork purposes. So a lot of my insights are from, which I also share in the book, are from seeing things, which, you know, learning from failures, learning from, hey, if this could have been done this way, it would have been better, or this would have been done this way, it would have been better, because there's not a lot of best practices around risk management. It's, you know, it's such a, it's so diverse across all sectors, and all sectors view it so differently. I think one good job, which ISO 31000 did, was to somehow like harmonize or give a theory of everything around it, of what, how risk should be defined and how phases of risk management should be defined. But then as you go into the details in terms of the product, process, and services, it just becomes so complex and so, I guess, personalized would be a word to each sector. So I think when I wrote the book, I was trying to, with the foundation of ISO 31000, I was trying to come up with something which anybody from any sector can use. You can flip through the pages, see which tools and methods apply to you, but also at the same time, really understand the context around what you're using, the pitfalls around what can happen if you don't use it properly. So those were, my main motivations to write a book. And it was basically for any level of practitioner, like anybody can pick it up. And, if you don't have to be a master or anything, I wrote it in a way that a novice can pick up and get some foundation and, start practicing sound risk management practices.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Jayad. And first of all, hats off, because you're one of the few individuals in this space who has, spent obviously a lot of your time focusing on professionalizing your own approach to risk management by, certifications and membership of societies. And yet we find a lot of people who, like yourself in your first job, get the job of doing, participating in a risk assessment, and they have absolutely no formal basis. So I know it's one of my drivers as an educator in the TU Dublin, in the University in Dublin, and also through the Quality Risk Management Institute, is to try and professionalize the approach to quality risk management. So it's not just the youngest member of the QA team that gets, that pulls the short straw on having to try and beat their colleagues into a room to try and get them to sit down and participate in a risk assessment. So hats off to you for that. So let's get started and dive right in. In the opening pages of your book, you state that risk management is compulsory, it's indispensable, and it's necessary for compliance. And of course, we all know that. as you also then go on to say, almost every industry has its own little customized niche version of risk management. But the bottom line is that this is often the truth that we find in the field, in practice, is that risk management often fails. Risk management often becomes a paper exercise, as you said, and risk management can become reactive and passive. And, we've spent the past year on this podcast tackling some of these truths that you mentioned with many of our guests. So talk to me about your thoughts on how can we shift from this reactive, passive risk management or disaster management, as you call it. If you're reacting, if you're firefighting, you're already in disaster management mode, towards this much more proactive management of risk within our businesses.
Right. So I think the foundations are there. We've got the tools, we've got the method, and a lot of times we've even got the resources. However, in regulated industries, I've noted that risk management is so driven by compliance, and folks are hesitant to do anything which needs paperwork or messes the audit trail. And at the bottom of it, I think nobody has spoken of this in this way, but I think there's a timidity around it. There's not enough agility in organizational systems. And sometimes it's burdened by document control systems, procedures, internal rules, expectations, et cetera, right? Now, let's go back to understanding what proactive means. So proactive means preventing and reducing risk by identification, analysis, evaluation, and treatment. It also means being ready for risk realization. When these are missing, we go into the reactive zone. And make no mistake, there will always be a reactive component. But I think like any person who has spent managing risk in a full-time job for maybe, or even partly, I think for a year or a little bit more than that, that's all it takes. I think every risk manager, engineer, specialist knows what's needed, knows how it should be. However, the organizational energy is missing, and the energy comes from top management. Top management should not only support, but be active participants on the enterprise level of risk management and clearly understand how risk flows within the organization down to the product, process, or service level. Just having an FMEA for your product or something is not going to do it. It has different levels to it. And in my book, I think it's in the first chapter where I show that circle where it starts with the product service and goes into operations and then goes into enterprise. So that's my version of making sense of ISO 31000 and how it applies to my product or my service or my process. And top management should make sure that risk management system is actively being updated, actively being worked upon, and any kinks are removed. So, and I've seen that happen. I've seen that happen a couple of times, and it's a beautiful thing when it happens. I was in conversations with someone who actually did the whole risk management for Chrysler Pacifica for a couple of years. And they did work around failure modes beautifully. Like every complaint was fed back and there was a perfect feedback loop. Defects were continuously reduced. Documents were continuously updated. There was that loop of identification, analysis, evaluation, treatment, and communication. So, all that is very important. And all that going back, it takes energy and sometimes it takes courage, right? And I think that is something which I personally feel is missing in some organizations. Now, anybody can react. Reaction is not risk management. Planning, analysis, evaluation, and then responding, then that's real risk management.
Yeah. And I love what you say there about the timidity and the burden. I think you're right. You've hit the nail on the head, and we've certainly talked about this before in the podcast about within the regulated industries, it gets relegated to being a compliance activity. Yeah. And that's why it doesn't get the level of energy that it needs. And it certainly doesn't get that kind of leadership. And you talk in the book about risk culture. We've had a whole couple of podcast episodes on risk culture. But it does require that joined up thinking. And I liked that diagram in your book where you had that product and process level, which is where, most folks are comfortable with doing their FMEAs in that space and having them, down there at that process level. What they're not doing is connecting that up to that operational level where at a business unit or a functional level, they can prioritize based on their risk horizon and their appetite for risk of what are they taking on and what are they, where are they putting their resources? And what it's absolutely not necessarily connected to is that kind of high level enterprise risk register or whatever, so that they can see strategically where are our issues. What we find in practice is that there's hundreds of risk treatments, buried in databases and FMEAs and risk, registers down at that product and process level. And really, it almost becomes a batting average of how many of them can we eliminate or how many of them can we dodge until we get hit by the, the dodgeball where one of them comes back to us. But that's because that operational and enterprise level is not helping to prioritize what are the ones that we really need to focus on and where are the big hits for us as an as a business and from a reputational perspective, but most importantly because of the regulated industry we're in, our end users or our patients, So I totally agree with that. And I guess if leaders could take one message away from the effective risk management of executing a proactive approach, it is that it's a critical business capability and not just a compliance activity. And that, for instance, might be the way in which we can inject a little bit more energy into this, where they can see that, they have a greater ability to meet their strategic objectives. And picking up on some of those items that you mentioned, I'd like to you to take some time to talk to us about the distinction that you make in the book about risk response is different from risk reaction. So let's draw that one out a little bit, if you would, please.
Yeah, sure. So risk management will occur with or without a structured, documented process in the organization. We continually make decision by factoring variety of risk in our daily lives. Same is true for organizational decision makers. Response is a measured reply to any threat or opportunity. This involves taking into consideration all the phases of risk management, which I just talked about: identification, analysis, evaluation, treatment, and communication. Now, this doesn't happen often in the real world. the CEO says do something and the whole organization, you know, runs around to do that. The CQA says something, the director says something, we do it and hope for the best. Now that's a reaction, which is an unmeasured, unevaluated reaction based on incompletely processed information. So those are two major differences. Now, in, you know, going back to the words proactive, now the proactive word is used so often these days, it's sort of, you know, starting to lose a little bit of a meaning. But I was browsing LinkedIn this morning, and one of my colleagues from the country of Azerbaijan, she made a post where she said that, let's talk about risk management as offensive versus defensive. And, you know, proactive has sort of become defensive. You have to be on the offensive with risk management. Go out there and look for things to update, like look for risks, and you will find opportunities that way also. So I love that word. And I think I'm going to weave it into an article in the future because people are so used to the word proactive now is just, you know, become a part of the vocabulary and sort of starting to lose its actual meaning.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think, you know, I'll come back to that when we talk in a little while on that whole concept of continual improvement. But, you know, a further problem that you deal with in your book is with traditional quality risk management approaches is that it's often siloed. We find that this joined up thinking isn't happening. And you approach it in a much more holistic way. And again, this is something we've talked about on the podcast here. We did one episode saying taking the Q out of QRM, you know, because certainly within a regulated industry, it gets talked about as quality risk management. But in fact, you know, we believe that it's risk management, and whether that's you're looking at your supply chain management, whether you're looking at your business continuity management, or whether you're looking at a product or process defect, they're all risks, and each of them can have an impact on your ability to deliver to your stakeholders. So talk to me a little bit about this concept of how can we break down these silos, and how can we get that much more holistic view of risk management, just like the ISO 31000 frameworks that you talked about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm completely aligned with you on that. When I first wrote the book, the title of the book was Foundations of Risk Management. And I was insistent on having that title, but ultimately, since Quality Press published it, they wanted the word quality in there. But to me, it's you're right. It is risk management, and it involves the whole hierarchy of things. I will share an article with you for the listeners where I talk about this in more detail. But it goes back to the pyramid I have. So at the top of the pyramid is strategic quality management, strategic risk management. And then you have operational quality management, operational risk management, product service process quality management, and product service risk management. And all of these things should talk. And the scope of risk management must extend right from that enterprise level to the product process service level. Now, the mainstay of quality teams generally has been that lowest rung. So, and generally about the other levels, people are making decisions about risks consciously or subconsciously, but there is no synchrony or harmony with what's happening at the product, service or process level. So it's important, number one, for everyone in the business to be aware of this hierarchy. And this hierarchy is not something new. Actually, this whole challenge which risk is having right now about, 70 years ago, quality management had this challenge. This diagram is actually from the Joseph Juran's book on leadership for quality. I think he published it in 1990, but at that time he was about 80 years old or so. But that diagram comes from him, where he says, generally, quality is perceived as inspection, which is done after production, but nobody's thinking of strategic quality. And that was Joseph Juran's contribution to the profession in the 50s and 60s, where he talks about strategic quality. I feel like this is the time when in the field of risk management, we are at a similar crossroads. We need to understand that it's just not that one rung, and that, you know, it extends upwards for it to be useful, effective, and, you know, for it to be able to have some effect, real effect on the bottom line and not just a compliance thing. So we must be aware of the rungs of decision-making above and below us, which will not only affect the risk at our own level, but affect the success or failure of the overall risk management efforts and overall organizational goals. And I recently wrote an article for Quality Progress. It was accepted last month, come out probably in a year or so. And I talk about the evolution of risk management. And it has gone from something which was just transactional to risk is bad, just focus on transferring this risk. And then it goes to somewhere where risk is an expense, let's control it, let's manage it, to what now ISO 31000 is saying, which the definition, which I feel like is the definition of everything, is risk is effect of uncertainty on objectives. So you have to focus on optimization, focus on decision-making and ability to respond and recover. So why do we want to do that? Because we want to create and protect value throughout the organization. So, and here the word proactive means preventing and reducing risks at the same time, integrating risk management system and risk transfer techniques and everything.
Yeah, and you know, you're so right. And actually, I leaned on ISO 31000 for a definition. A lot of the work that I do is around excellence in, you know, moving from the concept of quality towards excellence, where, you know, where we can have good quality or bad quality. And we have, you know, no end of databases of our deviations and our kappas and our investigations, but we can't have bad excellence. So I a lot of the strategies that I work with organizations is around embedding these concepts of excellence into the business. And one of them is around the work that I do on risk management. I've leaned on 31000 to create a definition for ourselves on what risk excellence is. And it is about breaking down these silos, because it talks about that everyone who is involved in creating value in the business is equally involved in protecting that value.
Absolutely.
And they can't do that unless they understand what their relationship is to the risk and to the outcomes that matter to the business. Because very often it's, you know, the C-suite understand perhaps what those outcomes are, but the folks who are at the front line, whether that is at a lab bench or a production line, they don't see their connection. And so part of that for me is that we have to ensure that they understand what their contribution is to creating that value, but also what their eyes and ears can bring every day, every batch, every run, in order to be able to surface issues proactively or offensively, as you say. Absolutely. And therefore get, you know, that they see, you know, risk is their job, not just, and that's one of the reasons why I like to knock the Q out of QRM, because as soon as you put the Q in front of it in a regulated industry, everybody else in the business thinks it's the folks in the white coats that are going to take care of managing it and documenting it and mitigating it. So yeah, that's one of the ways I see of crowdsourcing. I talk about it as crowdsourcing and risk identification, so that at the tier meetings, at the shift huddles, there's an opportunity systematically for people to raise their voice, to speak up and say, I saw something that didn't quite look right today, and surface it that way, rather than this kind of normalization of deviation that we wait until we've already got the horses bolted and we've already got the deviation before we actually start to think about a risk treatment or whether our control strategy was appropriate or not. So yeah, great. I'm loving this. We could be here for a long time, Ben and Stacey. Look, another area that we talked a lot about on this podcast before is the essential relationship or even integration between risk management, continual improvement, and of course, change management. And you mentioned this concept of continual improvement, of being of that risk process being live. It's not a one and done process. So share your thoughts about that integration between risk, continual improvement, and change management.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about a year and a half ago, I was invited by the Confederation of Indian Industry to talk about a topic of Kaizen risk management. And, I gave an example there of, and humor me for a second here. So an interesting factoid I discovered was that lobsters, they can theoretically never die. the telomeres don't age, so they don't age. So if you just let a lobster be, the lobster can grow and grow and grow and grow forever and never die. But however, what the lobster does is that it needs to shed its skin and grow. So, and that process of shedding the skin is a very tricky process. And because then the lobster is completely vulnerable, and then it has to hide under a rock or something. When that lobster is vulnerable, anybody can eat it. And that's how most of the lobsters die, because you know, they don't manage the risk around their skin shedding phase. So change is important for the lobster to survive and grow. And Kaizen is something like that. It's a change, a good change that leads to growth and some positive effect on a bottom line. Like, that's the whole point of change management. But you have to assess the time and opportunity for transformation. And this assessment is somewhere where risk management can help you. I remember reading an example in a book, I think it was by W. Edwards Deming, where he talked about this machine at a Ford manufacturing plant, which would automatically shift after each point was outside of the nominal, and it created an output which was completely off the charts. So that's what something which Deming referred to as tampering. So without understanding the context of the system and output of the system, if you are just moving or reacting to each data point, you know, you're just doing a change for the sake of a change, you're doing a Kaizen for sake of a Kaizen, that leads to tampering and that leads to unintended consequences. Instead, understand and assess the context in terms of risk of what that change is gonna do. So I'm sure most listeners will be familiar with Kaizen wheel or the Schwartz cycle or PDCA cycle, PDSA cycle. All steps in that cycle involve uncertainty. All steps will involve measurement, comparison, and where needed, some might involve innovation. So, you know, we have to understand what is the uncertainty around that change. And then as risk enlightened folks, we have to identify, analyze, evaluate, and treat that uncertainty to make sure that whatever change we're gonna do is gonna have a positive impact on the bottom line.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, one of the things that I really liked in your book is where you use the PDCA, you know, the Schwartz cycle, and your annotations around that cycle include the, you know, what often gets forgotten, the tail end of the process, which is after you've implemented that risk treatment, is that effectivity checks, you know, that risk review, risk evaluation. And I liked the terms that you were using, is that agility there and the learning. What did we learn? How can we adapt on the basis of what we've learned? So what should we be doing more of, and what should we be doing less of as a result of what we've learned in terms of this, you know, continual improvement or risk reduction activity. And in fact, you know, it's one of the things that I often say to the folks that, you know, in organizations that I work with, you know, when I'm in there doing work on operational excellence, I'm saying to them, you need to build relationships with your risk management team. And when I'm in working with the risk management team, I say, you need to build relationships with your Lean Six Sigma OPEX teams, because you're actually both solving the same problems here.
Right.
It's two sides of the one coin. For every continuous improvement activity, there should be a measurable and commensurate reduction in risk to the business or to the process or whatever part of the hierarchy that you're the rung on the hierarchy that you're on. And it is a double-sided coin, but very often we see either, you know, risk management is in there trying to reactively very often fix a deviation through a CAPA process. We might come back to that CAPA, you know, corrective, because, you know, 90% of what we're doing on CAPAs is it tends to be corrective. And at the same time, you might have some Lean Six Sigma people working or OPEX folks working on continual improvement, and they're approaching something from a, you know, from a completely different angle, perhaps. And in fact, the tools that they use and the, you know, the outcomes that they're looking for are completely aligned. And very often you don't find those two sides of the house talking and working together based on a priority in the organization. So that's just one thing. One of the other things before we move on that I did also like, and we dealt with this in great detail in a disruptive fashion in a couple of podcasts ago, Stacey, you remember we had Karen with us and she mentioned ISO 9001 2015 version. And the fact that, you know, those kind of corrective actions are now no longer part of the lexicon within the 9001 2015, and that it is about prevention and prediction. That's what, you know, the job of the quality risk management system should be about. And you also raise that, Jayat, in your book. I mean, that's a significant sea change within that.
Great. And so the thing about the preventive approach is, again, going back to the discussion we had about being proactive and less of being reactive. ISO 9001 talks about preventive approach a lot. And I think one of the big controversies there was that you don't need to have preventive action anymore. That word was taken out, and then everybody was like, oh, what does that mean? Now you're only gonna have corrective action. And the makers of the standard says, that is implicit in everything you do. And that is bolstered by the addition of risk management principles throughout the standard. So I think it is one of the chapters in my book, which specifically calls out each and every clause, which refers to risk.
I like that table. Yeah,
in really, ISO 9001.
Yeah, really, really helpful. You went down right through all the clauses to really identify and pull that thread through the framework there about the fact that this is actually about being predictive and preventative. That is the nature of a quality management system now. And it's not about correction. The fact that they took the term CAPA out, you know, threw lots of people off. But really it is about that prediction and that ability. As you say, I think you use the term risk resilience or risk vigilance, which I liked, you know, about the importance of really putting in a good monitoring system and risk review system so that you're checking for that effectivity.
Right. And I think that is extremely important. A lot of times organizations just wait for events to happen, even though they have mature systems. Like, nobody's actively going out there and scanning the horizon and looking for things. So that's what I refer to as risk vigilance. And I give a lot of tools to do that. But keep in mind that the regulatory bodies, FDA or MHRA or, you know, a lot of other things, EMA, they already have very mature vigilance tools. They are leveraging every, statistical tool, or I think FDA has a lot of stuff around the Sentinel system. They do a lot of work around that. They are being vigilant about things. They are crunching this data, the adverse event reports and this and that, and they have the numbers, they have the occurrence rate. So as manufacturers, we have to be vigilant on the same level. Otherwise, we won't know what hit us when these notified bodies or regulatory authorities or somebody shows up at our door and they'll be like, hey, this is what's happening. And you are in complete, denial about what was going on. And I think one term which you mentioned, I like that very much, was normalization of deviance, which was, I forgot who coined that, but it was related to the Challenger
space
shuttle.
And Diane Vaughan is her name.
I have that book here. And that is just so true. When you're going in an organization, working 8 hours, day in and day out, looking, let's say you're part of customer complaints team, you're looking at the same complaint again and again for a year, normalization of deviance can happen so easily, you won't even notice it. So it's very important to have these systems, these objective systems, which will reduce bias and noise around data and data analysis, which I collectively term as risk vigilance. It also goes into that word which I just said before was being offensive about risk, like be out there and, you know, be like a sponge to see what's happening out there and how can that affect, you know, going back to the definition, effect of uncertainty on objectives. So how can that affect my objectives? And you also mentioned about every person adding value. So every person adds value in terms of the objective that person has and the organization has provided that. And all these objectives line up as you go up, right? So for example, if the CEO has an objective, there's operationally something to realize that. And at the end of the day, the worker who's working on the floor on some level is working to fulfill that objective, but that objective looks different for this person than for the CEO. So it all goes back to the effect of uncertainty on objectives.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you've mentioned something there about the agencies themselves having well-defined risk vigilance and risk surveillance tools. And with my colleagues in St. Gallen University and now partnering with additional colleagues in Columbia University, we kicked off a project for FDA called Risk Surveillance. Mm. And where last Monday just so for the next year we'll be working to look at these new models of new sources of data analysis and our colleagues in the AI and machine learning area in Columbia are working with us about what kind of publicly available data could we be scraping to assist being more predictive about where they spend their resources, as you say, their objective, yeah. Which is, you know, the protection of public health. And certainly post-pandemic, you know, they know they can't put boots on every ground. So how can they, you know, be much more discerning about the various sources of data? How can we collate that down both at an operational level, but also at a, you know, compliance history level, but also at this publicly available data level, to try and find a mechanism by which that would be, we can identify where those triggers are. And that brings us nicely to this kind of Pharma 4.0 or the use of data analytics and machine learning and artificial intelligence, which you also talk about in your book. And maybe this is a whole other podcast, Stacey. We're going to have to get Jayed back to talk about it. But tease us a little bit. One of the things that you say in your book is like a risk management system from industry 3.0 based on small data sets and lesser data points will be significantly less effective than a risk management system that embraces and leverages the power of big data and connectedness. And I think you're spot on there. A lot of our traditional systems are still in the 3.0 or God forbid, even the 2.0 era. Tease us a little bit about some of your thoughts there. And like I say, we may have to come back to it.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about there, but I think I'll give you an example. Recently, I was made aware of, so I wrote an article recently on benefit risk analysis of the COVID vaccine. Somebody came up with a proposal to analyze, hey, is Moderna more effective or Pfizer or whatever? And so we did that. And then after publication of an article, a consulting firm decided to use machine learning to continuously scan the FDA VAERS database to feed into an algorithm, which continuously spits out that benefit risk analysis numbers. So let's say something like this were to happen in industry 3.0, somebody would just go on this one particular website, somebody would pull that data, somebody would crunch the number on a, you know, a monthly basis or a weekly basis, or even let's say if it's really important, go on a daily basis and do that. In 4.0, what we are looking for is multiple areas. So what this company is doing is not only going to the VERS database, but all database around it. And you need machine learning for that. You need a little bit of AI, a little bit of coding for this, because there's a lot of data everywhere. Like each country has something, some countries don't, mm-hmm. some countries need, you know, there's some differences there which need to be accounted for. So there's all these hundreds of data points, all these countries reporting things, reporting adverse events based on which vaccine. There's some information about demographics. In some cases, it's missing. So there's an analytics portion to it. There's a prioritization portion to it. And all of that requires we leverage AI and machine learning, because a single person with pre-specified data points will not be able to do that. So you'll need probably like 50 people to do that job, which a simple thread of code can do for you daily, or even on a, you know, hourly basis as data comes in. So that is like a very practical encounter I had with risk management 4.0, because even in the past, when I've looked at FDA databases and such for adverse events, we usually go to the MOD database for medical device, come out with a report and say, hey, these are the occurrences and stuff. Paradigm has changed now. You know, regulatory bodies themselves, everybody, now there's social media. You people talk about things in social media. There's various literature and this and that. And you need something to sweep all these sources of information, because there's no dearth of data anymore. There's, you know, data is everywhere. And at the end of the day, also, technology is only means to an end. And, you know, technology will not make direct decisions for us. So it is just an enabler that can enrich the informed decision by providing accurate and precise data. So in even using technology, you have to be very mindful, like, you know, because it's a thread of code. Like, there's so many differences in these data sets. Like, sometimes you need to truly understand what that code is doing to make sure you don't get garbage out. You have to be able to tweak it as needed and do things as needed. So that's why, despite all the good stuff, all the processing, data gathering abilities we have, risk intelligence cannot be delegated to a technology. And I give the example in my book that, you know, Siri has IQ of, I think, 23 or something, right? So Siri can get to more information than you or me at this particular second, right? But it has an IQ of 23 because it doesn't have reasoning. It doesn't have critical thinking. Those are domains of humans. So risk intelligence 4.0 is different from, you know, risk data gathering and processing 4.0. So that risk intelligence is important for any of your technology or any other initiative to make sense and, again, have an effect on the bottom line.
Yeah, I really like that. And I know from one of our other research colleagues, Paige Kane, she talks about what was the, you know, the traditional data information knowledge wisdom hierarchy. Uh-huh. And she adapted that through her own knowledge management and knowledge excellence research of data information knowledge and insights, because that's really that decision, risk-based decision making. It's that insights that we need to be able to make those well-informed decisions. And wisdom is a little bit Yoda, you know, it's a little bit nebulous out there. But listen, I could talk to you all day, but unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap for today. We're definitely going to have you back another day. But I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for sharing your passion and your expertise with our listeners. And what do you think,
Stacey? That was amazing. I learned so much just from this discussion. I'm definitely going to have to go back and read the book. But Nuala, what are some of our takeaways from today's Risk Revolution episode with Jayette?
Yeah, well, of course, we're going to provide the link to the ASQ website to Jay's great book. But we've also got a goodie bag coming. Jayette is going to provide us with as soon as we've just finished the trick or treat period, he's going to provide us with a goodie bag of links to his other articles. So so definitely click into the show notes for those. And thank you, Jayette, once again. Over to you, Stacey.
Absolutely. Well, thank you to both of our risk revolutionaries, Nuala and Jayette, for such a fascinating discussion. I also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen. And lastly, we thank you, our audience. We are grateful for your listenership and help in sharing these great podcast episodes. So if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to leave us an online review and share with your friends, colleagues, and virtual networks. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, please send them our way. And for today's show notes, including links to the goodie bag that Nuala was just talking about and additional information on this podcast, please visit www.ivtnetwork.com/podcast. We'll be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, make it a great week.